Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian's magazine here on OWL Radio. Smithsonian covers a broad spectrum of topics in so many different fields. We're going to start out today with one that certainly is nature. And it is from the November of 2023 edition of this wonderful magazine. It is in the segment of the magazine called Heroes of the Wild. Going to bat for nature. There's your clue. Going to bat for nature. So, I wonder what kind of animal that could be. Well, it's certainly the title gives it away. This was written by Carolyn Cranking. And the subtitle, once seen as a menace, the gray-haired, oh, flying fox brings new life after Australia's wildflower fires. I said bat. It is a variety of bat, even though he's called a flying fox. And it's because his head looks like the head of a fox. Small, of course, but looks like the head of a fox. As darkness descends across the eastern coast of Australia, thousands of gray-headed flying foxes take to the skies. Armed with a keen sense of smell and sharp night vision, they roam to find food after resting all day. Some might travel as far as 30 miles in one night, foraging for fruits such as figs and pollinating trees as they go. Gray-headed flying foxes are actually the largest native bat species in Australia, with wingspans up to 3 feet. They're found nowhere else in the world, but as urbanization destroys their forest habitat and droughts make food scarce, their population has plummeted. Though the bats numbered in the millions in the early 1900s, fewer than 400,000 may exist today. The species is listed as vulnerable by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. With less of their natural habitat remaining, the bats are forced to seek food closer to people, bringing them into contact with new threats. Mesh netting over urban fruit trees can wrap around them when they try to eat, and barbed wire, a fixture on many Australian farms, might snare the bats as they fly. Some residents of cities are not happy to share their neighborhoods with congregations of flying foxes, which can be noisy at dawn and dusk and generate lots of poop. As a result, local governments try to disperse the camps. Each one could include thousands of bats with smoke guns, loud noises, or fireworks. It's not an effective strategy, as the bats have a tendency to move between roosts. They're continually replacing each other, says Claire Winter, flying fox coordinator with Canberra-based rescue organization ACT Wildlife. You don't have one bat coming back to the same place every night, so they're not really going to learn not to come back. Australia's bushfire season of 2019 to 2020 was devastating to the flying fox population, killing tens of thousands. But the fires also represented a turning point for the bats' reputation. Because they fly long distances during their nightly travels, the bats play a pivotal role in repollinating swaths of scorched land. Pollen sticks to their fur, and they also ingest fruits, which makes them excellent seed spreaders. A single flying fox can spread as many as 60,000 seeds per night. Everybody realized Hey, we're going to need as much help as we can get to regenerate all of this, says John Grant, a spokesman for the Australian Wildlife Rescue Organization, WIRES, which stands for Wildlife Information, Rescue, and Education Service. And the flying foxes are the best animals to do that, he says. In 2020, the New South Wales government posted a video praising the bats for their super pollinating power. So when some 85,000 flying foxes descended upon the city of Tamworth last year, news coverage wasn't all bad. In one account, a local resident called the bats flying vermin and complained about their smell, but others focused on how such vast bat congregations are an amazing sight. One resident compared the gathering to a local music festival and proclaimed, "We've got to live with them. They are great for our ecology." The fire changed the mindsets of a lot of people, Grant says. Most of New South Wales was in flames, and I think that people began to realize just how precious our wildlife is. Well, that's an encouraging story about this remarkable animal, the flying fox, the biggest variety of bat in Australia. New South Wales is in the southeast section of the country. So there was an article concerning nature and ecology in today's world. Our next one, which is from the January-February edition of Smithsonian, moves into history. It's from the prologue section. A subtitle is American Icon, but the name of this article is Command Center. And it was written by Richard Grant. The subtitle is, "From These Modest Wartime Quarters, George Washington Kept the Revolution Alive." And there is a picture of Washington's actual tent that is on display at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. 200 years ago, in the summer of 1824, the Marquis de Lafayette returned to America for the first time since he fought in the American Revolution. The Frenchman had become a major general in the Continental Army at the age of 19, was a close friend of George Washington's, and played a key role in the colonists' conclusive victory at Yorktown. Now, age 67, Lafayette traveled by steamboat to Fort McHenry in Baltimore, where a group of surviving officers from the Continental Army had assembled in Washington's tent from the Revolutionary War. Entering the threadbare canopy for the first time in nearly half a century, Lafayette and others were overcome and shed tears of glory, gratitude, and joy, as Secretary of State John Quincy Adams described them later that day. Today, Washington's war tent sits in the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, where it reigns as a rock star object, as the New York Times has called it. Before seeing the tent, visitors watch a stirring 12-minute film about its history and significance. When the projection screens lift away and dim lights finally reveal the tent itself, people have tears in their eyes literally every single time, says R. Scott Stevenson, the museum's president. The tent, then, has elicited tears for two centuries. To Lafayette, it was a consecrated object, as he put it, the sacred symbol of Washington's peerless wartime leadership. Now, this improbable survivor, nearly 250 years old, is regarded as a hallowed relic of the Revolutionary War, a symbol of the American Republic, even by some as the first Oval Office. Made of sturdy flax linen with red scalloped edges and shaped like a long oval when pitched, it is a typical 18th century marquee tent for high-ranking military officers. Its dimensions are approximately 23 feet long, 14 feet wide, and 12 feet high. Not a huge space, Stevenson says, and quite Spartan in its decoration, compared with the war tents of 18th century European monarchs like George III or Louis XVI. It was made in Reading, Pennsylvania during the Valley Forge encampment in the spring of 1778 as part of a replacement set for Washington's initial campaign tents, which had worn out. By electing to camp among his men and endure their hardships for the almost 7-year duration of the war, Washington was doing something highly unusual and calculated for effect. He was very consciously trying to model what leadership of the army in a republic would look like, Stevenson says. It was customary for military leaders to use buildings as their headquarters, and Washington attracted widespread attention for staying in his tent. It also served as his sleeping quarters and office, where he would sit alone reading and writing letters by candlelight. Some soldiers later remembered his glowing tent as the last thing they saw at night and the first thing they saw in the morning. After the war's end in 1783, the tent and the rest of Washington's military equipment went into storage at his Mount Vernon estate. Following his death in 1799, the tent took on new roles. It became a family heirloom for his wife, Martha, and her descendants. For the young country, it was treated as a national treasure and regularly put on display, most notably for Lafayette's visit in 1824. To commemorate the 200th anniversary of that occasion, the Museum of the American Revolution is opening a new exhibit this February, this month now, called Witness to Revolution, The Unlikely Travels of Washington's Tent. It's a kind of reunion, says curator Matthew Skick. The museum has brought together tent-related artifacts and artworks from many different collections. And all the known fragments of the tent that were cut off and given away as souvenirs. George Washington Parke Custis, President Washington's step-grandson, was particularly active in this scissor work, handing out the scraps with notes identifying their provenance. The exhibition tells the stories of Washington's companions in his war camps, including his enslaved valet, William Lee, who would dress him in the tent. Three of his aides-de-camps and the soldiers selected to guard the commander-in-chief. The latter part of the exhibition follows the tent's improbable journey through the 19th century to the present day. For two decades, it was the treasured possession of another legendary military leader, Robert E. Lee, who acquired joint ownership by marrying Martha Washington's great-granddaughter, Mary Custis. The tent was kept in their home at Arlington House. During the Civil War, Arlington was taken by the Union Army, and the tent was carried away to Washington, D.C., where it was displayed as a symbol of the Union cause. Then it became the subject of a long legal battle between the Lee family and the U.S. government, which ultimately returned the tent to Robert E. Lee's daughter. She sold it to the Reverend W. Herbert Burke of Norristown, Pennsylvania, to raise money for Confederate war widows, and the tent began a new career as a star object in museums, first at Valley Forge and then at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia, which opened in 2017. Asked if he knew of a more storied item of American camping gear, Stevenson said, "Absolutely not, and we discover new things all the time." The museum's conservator, Lorene Finkelstein, who preserved the tent through painstaking needlework, was at Mount Vernon on another project when she came across a piece of the tent that had been sitting in a drawer since the 1930s. And someone had just approached the museum with an item purchased at a Goodwill store, a small piece of linen with some red trim, now authenticated by the museum's experts, and an old note in pencil that said, part of George Washington's tent. It was a mobile field headquarters that became a relic and then a symbol, says Stevenson, and that's how it survived. Otherwise, who keeps old tents around? Interesting. And there's a picture of a detail from Gilbert Stuart's most famous portrait of Washington, and then another of a watercolor by Pierre-Charles Enfant, who served as an engineer in the Continental Army, a watercolor of the tent itself sitting on a hilltop in Valley Forge. There's a smaller article here that is entitled Right-Hand Men. The general's trusty military assistants went on to shape the young country, and this was written by Sonia Anderson. The first is Edmund Randolph. Randolph was recommended to Washington by Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson, who wrote to the general that the young lawyer's abilities cannot fail to gain him your countenance. After serving as an aide-de-camp in 1775, Randolph became governor of Virginia, U.S. Attorney General, and finally, Secretary of State. The next man, Robert Hanson Harrison. Maryland-born litigator Harrison was at the top of Washington's list when the war began, having already earned the commander's trust as his lawyer, and he became an aide-de-camp in 1775 before serving for years as Washington's military secretary. And then there's Stephen Moylan, M-O-Y-L-A-N. Hailing from Ireland, Moylan immigrated to Philadelphia in 1768 and built a respectable reputation as a trade merchant. In 1775, Washington appointed Moylan the muster master general of the Continental Army. The following year, he served as Washington's senior aide-de-camp and led a cavalry team. Now, that's a broad range of experiences that man had. And finally, William Palfrey. This well-educated Boston merchant served Washington as an aide-de-camp for just under 2 months in 1776 before rising to become the Army's paymaster general. In 1780, he was named the country's first consul to France, but never served his term. His ship was lost while crossing the Atlantic. They're fascinating times and difficult times, very difficult. In retrospect, so many sacrifices that those early people made to make our country the success it became. And now we are going to segue into sports as a type of article. The name of it is Making a Racket, and it was written by Bob Eckstein. The subtitle, How an Obscure Paddle Sport Became King of the Court. Court tennis was the first paddle and ball game in the world. Henry VIII, one of the sport's earliest and most fervent fans, erected the first pavilion at Hampton Court Palace, some 12 miles southwest of London, around 1527. And the wacky game, gentlemen had to play bounce shots off awnings that jutted from the walls, soon grew popular in France as well. By the late 16th century, the sport had spread across Europe and become a ubiquitous obsession. By 1596, Paris alone boasted more than 250 court tennis courts. Court tennis sits atop the family tree of all racket sports. Branches shoot off to create lawn tennis, squash, and racquetball, explains Tony Hollins, the head court tennis pro at the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. Another descendant, the game immensely fashionable these days, known as pickleball. In 1965 on Bainbridge Island, two friends, Washington State Congressman Joel Pritchard and businessman Bill Bell, dreamed up pickleball on an old badminton court with a pair of ping pong tap paddles. Pritchard and Bell adopted the same simple rules as those of court tennis from more than four centuries earlier. A player uses a paddle or racket to hit a ball over a net before it can bounce twice. The two spent a weekend experimenting, during which they lowered the net and moved the court onto asphalt. The next weekend, a third friend, Barney McCallum, helped further flesh out the rules of their new sport. They were to be much simpler than court tennis, which had featured all manner of eccentricities, including a moat under the net. Pickleball, by contrast, would have simpler scoring than modern tennis. Each point is worth one and be accessible to all ages. It requires a simpler skill set. And the projectile is rather like a wiffle ball and thus easier to return. Pickleball has no relation to pickles, though there's some debate about the origins of the name. Some say it originated with Pritchard's wife Joan, a competitive rower. A pickle boat refers to a group of rowers arbitrarily thrown together, and thus evokes pickleball's shaggy dog appeal to amateurs of all skill levels. Others say it came from one of the inventor's dogs, who was named Pickles. Two residents of Washington State, Sid Williams and Brian Olson, worked with other pickleball enthusiasts to found the United States Amateur Pickleball Association in 1984, which created the sport's first official rule book. The first national doubles championship was held that year in Tacoma, Washington, and the game has remained popular there. In 2022, pickleball became Washington's official state sport, and as of 2023, it was the fastest-growing sport in the United States, in large part because it's hard to beat the sport's inclusivity. Pickleball courts can pop up anywhere. Backyards, parking lots, driveways, and perhaps soon, will we see it in the Olympics? With breakdancing, surfing, and skateboarding all included in the 2024 Paris Olympics, pickleball might not be far behind. Isn't that curious? And of course, many have probably heard of the chain of restaurants called Chicken and Pickle, which I've never gone to, but I'd be curious to know which takes precedence. Is it the pickleball or is it the chicken? Who's to say? So that was actually sports, a little bit of sports, a little bit of history, all kinds. Interesting for origin of a new sport, relatively new sport. The next article is under prehistory, and it's called The Writing on the Wall, Back to Archaeology. With help from a now extinct bear, archaeologists have unlocked the mysteries of Spain's Cova Donus. This was written by Sonia Anderson. Discovering any collection of Paleolithic art is rare, says Aitor Ruiz Redondo, an archaeologist and senior lecturer at the University of Zaragoza in Spain. Only about 400 such sites have been found worldwide, but to come upon more than 100 prehistoric motifs created over 24,000 years ago using unorthodox methods and preserved in a cave by a stroke of chemical luck is simply extraordinary. Cava Donus, the cave in question, lies close to Spain's eastern coast in Valencia, whereas most of the country's ancient art, including the famous prehistoric cave paintings of Altamira, is in northern Spain. First explored by Ruiz Redondo and colleagues in 2021, Cava Donus is home to at least 110 paintings, drawings, and engravings. Many of the motifs depict animals, female red deer, wild horses, and now extinct oxen. Unlike other Paleolithic paintings, typically made with ochre or manganese, most of Cava Dona's paintings were done in clay and conserved by chemistry. Cava Dona's is a karstic cave, Ruiz Redondo says, meaning its walls and standing water are rich in calcium carbonate, a natural paint preservative. Early humans likely scooped red clay from the cave's floor and walls, mixing it with water at their feet. They were, inadvertently or not, creating a minerally reinforced paint. Then thousands of years of water trickling into the cave deposited a layer of calcium carbonate over their work, sealing it to the wall for Ruiz Redondo to find so many centuries later. Determining the age of cave art is delicate work. Ruiz Redondo and his team are awaiting a full laboratory analysis of Cava Dona's motifs, including radiometric dating of their crusty mineral coverings. But until then, a couple of logical approaches provide some clarity. First, some of the motifs are drawn in a style that's typical of a period about 21,000 to 40,000 years ago, according to dating at other Paleolithic sites, Ruiz Redondo says. Second, one of the drawings was defaced in a telling way. It was covered by a bear scratch, Ruiz Redondo says. The mark was made by a cave bear, an animal that went extinct 24,000 years ago. And its placement allows the team to determine that the motif predates the bear's extinction. Archaeology has always had a romantic part, Ruiz Redondo says, a sense of discovery, if you will, especially with the paintings. Nobody has seen this horse in thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Until now. Archaeology has always sounded like a fascinating and exciting field to be in. And that man certainly is excited about his discovery in that Paleolithic cave in eastern Spain. And finally, Ask Smithsonian. There are a couple more questions here that we'll cover. The first is, can every living thing be traced to a single cell? And that was asked by Benjamin Schwartz of Oak Park, Michigan. The answer from Dave Pawson, researcher of invertebrate zoology at the National Museum of Natural History, answers, scientists agree on the basics of how life began, perhaps 4 billion years ago. Inorganic materials in the depths of the sea, subjected to favorable chemical conditions, most likely came to form a primitive slime over a long period of time. That slime eventually gave rise to bacteria, or perhaps blue-green algae. No one knows whether these early life forms developed in several different regions or in one part of the ocean, or from a single cell, as you suggest. When it comes to that level of precision, we may never arrive at a universally accepted answer. And that's from Dave Pawson of the National Museum of Natural History. You have been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.